Okay, thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium Session 376, titled Freemasonry's Impact on Mormon Mourning in Nauvoo. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. In Mormon Nauvoo, there was barely a person who did not feel the pangs of a loved one's death. At the passing of one of his dear friends, King Follett, Joseph Smith sought to comfort those who had experienced loss. Secreted within the words of his sermon were Masonic themes which many in the audience had ears to hear. Joseph's own death, greatly mourned by his followers, would contain Masonic elements. Cheryl and Nick will present the mythology of grief contained within Freemasonry's legends and rituals. They will demonstrate how these features were present in the teachings, death, and burials of Mormonism's founder. Cheryl L. Bruno is director of resident life at Forest Hills Retirement Community. Her passions are poetry and Mormon history. Cheryl and Nick are co-authors with Joe Steve Swick III of the book Method Infinite, Freemasonry and the Mormon Restoration. Nicholas S. Latursky is assistant editor of the journal Anthropology of Consciousness, an adjunct faculty. Their interests include depth psychological reflections on spirituality, cave art, sexual orientation, and gender identity. I'll now give the floor over to our presenters and encourage you to come up with questions for later.
Hi, everyone. My name is Cheryl Bruno, and I'm excited to be here with Nick, my co-author, and present to you a little bit about our research on Freemasonry in Nauvoo. In the 1760s, a set of pamphlets were published in France which contained an early form of the Scottish Rite degrees. From the allegorical conversation of the masters comes this: "Where were you made a master mason? In a dark place where tears and moans prevailed. How did you enter? By a winding staircase with 3, 5, and 7 steps. What did you see when you entered the lodge? Dismal light, profound silence, and bitter grief." The Master Mason's degree is all about secrets, the building of a temple, and murder, thus death. In the presentation of the degree, Masons act out the central legend of Hiram Abiff, the chief architect employed by the biblical King Solomon to build his temple in Jerusalem. Probably a lot of our audience know the story of the legend of Hiram Abiff, but I'll go ahead and just give a quick review. One evening, as the construction of the temple, Solomon's temple, was nearing completion, three fellow craft masons from the workforce ambushed Hiram one at a time. Each challenged him in turn, demanding the secrets of a master mason. At each refusal to divulge the information, his assailant struck him with a mason's tool. The third and final blow killed Hiram, and the fellow crafts buried him on the brow of the hill of Mount Moriah. Searchers were sent out under the direction of King Solomon, and one of them found the body under a sprig of acacia. The body of Hiram Abiff was raised and reburied in a more suitable place, in or near the Holy of Holies of the temple. The three ruffians were found and punished for their crime, but through the death of Hiram, the master's word had been lost. Freemasons are now tasked to search for and recover this sacred word. As every Mormon knows, the story of Nauvoo is also one of secrets, the building of a temple, and murder. But not every Mormon knows the role that Freemasonry played in framing this story. I really do believe that Masonry's legends and rituals contain a transformative power to transcend the human condition. The presence of a Masonic lodge in the city beginning in 1842 gave its people ritual and symbolism to assuage their grief. There are many little clues that this was so, beginning a couple of weeks after the installation of Nauvoo Lodge. For example, on April 4th, 1842, Ephraim, the son of William Marks, died at age 24. Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon both gave remarks at his funeral, and then the body was conveyed to the grave in solemn silence. As each person passed by, they dropped a branch of evergreen into the grave. The dropping of an evergreen branch, representing the sprig of acacia in the Hiram Abiff legend, is a cherished part of Masonic funerals. It accompanies a recitation that is found in the closing sentences of the monitorial lecture of the third degree. This evergreen is an emblem of our faith in the immortality of the soul. By this, we are reminded that we have an immortal part within us which shall survive the grave and which shall never, never, never die. This is just one of the ways Masonic legend and symbolism addresses loss. It is a theme with universal relevance as all humanity feels the pain of physical loss. I'm going to spend most of my time today on a sermon Joseph Smith gave at the passing of one of his dear friends, King Follett. In this talk, Joseph Smith sought to comfort those who had experienced grief. Hidden within the words of his sermon were Masonic themes, which many of the audience could recognize. On February 27, 1844, King, that was his first name, was digging a well when a rope holding a large tub of rock broke. The falling rocks and dirt crushed him. He was carried to his house where he lived for 11 more days in great pain before finally dying on Saturday, March 9th. That evening, his death was announced during a meeting of the Nauvoo Masonic Lodge, where he had been a Master Mason. You see the minutes to that meeting up on your screen. William S. Hathaway said that Brother King had indicated his desire to receive a Masonic burial. The next day, Sunday, March 10th, 1844, 119 members of the Masonic Lodge met at the newly built but as yet undedicated Masonic Hall in Nauvoo. The lodge was called from adjournment to labor on the third degree, and Worshipful Master Hiram Smith stated the object of the meeting, to carry to the grave a worthy brother, King Follett, who has for some time been a worthy member of our lodge and continued in good standing while he lived on the earth. Some brief remarks were made by Hiram, during which he presumably opened a lodge of sorrow in memory of their deceased brother. Then a procession was formed. A procession was assembled in due Masonic form. Accompanied by the Nauvoo Brass Band, lodge members proceeded to the Follett home to dress and prepare his body for burial and place it in the coffin. Masonic funerals necessitate that the body be dressed in an apron of white leather made of lambskin. A leather apron is worn by operative Masons, those who actually work on building buildings, to preserve their garments from stain, and thus in speculative Masonry, what we know as Freemasonry, the apron is a reminder to keep oneself pure and unspotted from the world. The lamb is an emblem of innocence, chosen by God himself to be offered to him in sacrifice as a type of the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. The apron typifies regeneration or new life, and this thought of resurrection may be the cause of its interment with the body of a deceased brother. The newly admitted apprentice is told that he is never to put on the apron if at variance with any brother who may be in the lodge. The procession from the Follett home to the gravesite was stunning. The band played somberly, with their drums muffled and trimmed with black lace. Led by Nauvoo Lodge Marshal John P. Green, the Masons were dressed in either dark suits or their Sunday best. Around their waists were tied aprons of white lambskin, and they wore white gloves, glittering regalia of their offices, and the deacons and stewards carried staffs. Members of the Nauvoo Lodge were followed by masons from visiting lodges, and then friends and family in carriages, on horseback and on foot, forming a procession which was described as being a mile in length. That evening, Joseph Smith preached at the regular Sunday meeting in the Grove. His address, a sermon on Elias and the priesthood, contained no reference to King Follett or to death in general. Yet Follett's obituary is rife with references to his faithfulness in the church and his valor in enduring the persecutions in Missouri. And his friends and family must have wondered why he had survived so many trials, only to be killed in such a mundane manner. Although they specifically requested Joseph Smith to speak at Follett's funeral, he did not take the opportunity to present a eulogy at that time. Yet, some weeks later, apparently having been profoundly affected by Follett's death, he delivered a stirring address which has come to be known as the King Follett Discourse. The speech is often referred to as a eulogy or a funerary discourse for the deceased, though it was given almost a month after the event. It has also been seen as a conference address, wherein Joseph used the circumstances of the tragic death of a prominent member of the church and fraternity to speak on the eternities and the status of the dead. However, its Masonic connections should not be overlooked. From Wilford Woodruff's journal, we see that Joseph originally intended to deliver this address on Friday, April 5th, 1844, the day of the dedication of the Nauvoo Masonic Hall. Woodruff says that because of illness, Smith opted to postpone his speech. Instead, he presented it at Sunday's conference, bringing Masonic elements to a sympathetic and specifically Latter-day Saint audience. The public nature of the event. This picture shows you how many people were there. They say that there were somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 people at this event. But the public nature presented Joseph with a predicament. As part of his Masonic obligation, he had promised at the altar of the lodge that he would always conceal and never reveal any part or parts, art or arts, point or points of the secret arts and mysteries of ancient Freemasonry. Knowing that his address would also be reproduced in the Times and Seasons, he also needed to keep in mind his obligation not to write, print, stamp, stain, hue, cut, carve, indent, paint, or engrave the secrets of Masonry. In order to include Masonic elements, Joseph Smith would have to give the discourse in a manner that other Masons had utilized before to give public addresses. These speakers alluded to Masonic themes in such a way that Freemasons would catch the references, but the common listener would not. Wilford Woodruff would later report Brigham Young's understanding of this method of discourse. Young said, "I could preach all about the endowments in public and the world know nothing about it. I could preach all about Masonry and none but a Mason know anything about it." I feel like this is really important, so I'm going to give you an example. I have three little brothers, and we are planning a trip next month. One of my brothers is still building his house, so he might not be able to come. In fact, all of my brothers have built their own houses. My third brother's house is going to be made of brick. He doesn't let very many people into his house. If you knock on his door and ask to be let in, he might say, "Not by the hair of my chin." By this point, you have recognized that these are three little pig brothers. You might not have known it by the fact that there were three brothers or that they had all built their own houses, but you might have suspected it when you learned that the third brother was building a brick house. And certainly when you heard that signal phrase, "Not by the hair of my chin," you knew. But if there is anyone in this audience who has never heard of the three little pigs story, if we were live, I'd have you raise your hand. You would not know that the brothers I was talking about have anything to do with pigs. Similarly, in the King Follett Discourse, one or two correspondences might have been coincidence. But as the talk unfolded, the Masonic connection was more and more evident. Joseph was moving these ideas directly into Mormonism in a way that he would continue to do in the Temple Endowment. After introducing his topic, Joseph Smith expounded upon the character of God. He revealed a great secret about deity in a statement that was to shock many in the audience. God himself, who sits enthroned in yonder heavens, is a man like unto one of yourselves, who holds this world in its orbit and upholds all things by his power. If you were to see him today, you would see him a man, for Adam was a man like in fashion and image like unto him. Smith did not believe that God had been God for all eternity. Rather, he was once a man like us, and the Father was once on an earth like us. Thus he reasoned that the Father must have also once had a body of flesh and bones, which was resurrected. Understanding this principle was necessary for his followers to be able to understand the character and being of God. Having taught the principle that God had once been mortal, Smith explained the corollary that men could become deities in their own right. You have got to learn how to be a god yourself in order to save yourself, to be priests and kings, as all gods have done by going from a small degree to another, from exaltation to exaltation, till they are able to sit in glory, as doth those who sit enthroned. The Masonic variation on the perfection of human personality is that not only can humans develop godlike qualities by perfecting themselves, but they have the innate potential to actually become gods. This is a Masonic thought. Masonic philosopher Manly Hall wrote, "All humans have within them the seed of their own perfection. It is not bestowed, it is revealed. Man is a god in the making, and as in the mystic myths of Egypt, on the potter's wheel, he's being molded." Three accounts of this portion of the discourse use the terminology of going from a small to a great capacity. William Clayton put this in Masonic terms by using the word degree, from a small degree to another. Clayton likely recognized this teaching as a Masonic principle. Wilford Woodruff's account also put the teaching in Masonic language to arrive at the station of a god, an allusion to the progression of the officers of a lodge. These brothers move from station to station, each one taking the place of the brother who has sat in that station previously, advancing by degrees, until arriving at the station of the worshipful master in the east and ascending the master's throne. In Freemasonry, the master of the lodge symbolizes deity. When Joseph explained that if his audience were to see God today, they would see him like a man in form, this would naturally have brought to Freemasons' minds the representation of God in the form of a man, the worshipful master of the lodge. Smith's comments regarding the ascent of the throne of eternal power invokes an image of the master of the lodge sitting upon his elaborate dais in the east. He represents God just as the lodge itself is symbolic of the created universe. Smith's next phrase, "with those who have gone before," uses the same wording as a threefold repetition in the entered apprentice degree, where a candidate petitions to receive the rights and benefits of the lodge as all true fellows and brothers have done who have gone this way before him. There are several phrases like this in the King Follett discourse, and they are recognizable just like the hair of my chinny chin chin. Additionally, Joseph Smith employed the use of figures such as that of a ladder featured in the entered apprentice degree to teach heavenly ascent and exaltation. When you climb a ladder, you must begin at the bottom rung until you learn the last principle of the gospel, for it is a great thing to learn salvation beyond the grave, and it is not all to be comprehended in this world. In speaking of the head one of the gods, Smith also described a head council composed of these divine beings. In Willard Richards' account, Joseph preached, "The head one called the gods together in grand council, where they concocted a scheme to create this world." The idea builds upon that found in Smith's scriptural recovery of the Book of Abraham, which depicts the motif of a divine grand council. Here, God, in the midst of an assembly of other divine beings, presided over the creation of the earth. This conception remarkably resembles the Masonic idea of a grand council in heaven, overseen by the grand master of the universe. Masonic governing bodies are similarly known as grand councils and are patterned after the heavenly grand council. Masons expect to be gathered into this august body after their mortal death, when the last sound of the gavel shall be heard and the secret vault forever closed. May we be permitted to enter the grand council above and with God and angels ever dwell. In the King Follett Discourse, Smith noted that religious philosophers of the day, or he called them doctors, taught that God created the earth out of nothing. He, however, took a more Kabbalistic and therefore Masonic view. Barau, Smith explained, meant to organize the world out of chaotic matter. In his view, elements were principles that could not be dissolved, although they could be organized and reorganized. Though the religious world counted it blasphemy at the time to say that elements had always existed, the idea went along with the motto of the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, Ordo ab Caio, or order from disorder. At the climax of the King Follett address, Smith combined two Masonic principles, Ordo ab Caio and the divine nature of man, to bring forth the idea of the immutability of the human spirit. As God is a self-existing being, so is man. His spirit and mind have no beginning or end. Joseph believed this subject was calculated to exalt the human race. A spirit model very similar to the one advocated by Joseph Smith was described by William Hutchinson in his book, The Spirit of Masonry. In this view, the supreme being was not the creator of the universe, nor the alone independent being, for according to them, the maintainers of the Egyptian philosophy, matter too was eternal. Hutchinson's book was well known throughout America and was continually published for over 100 years. Joseph Smith was well acquainted with these concepts. One of the fundamental principles of Masonic ritual is to link together both heaven and earth, the living and the dead, into what Freemasons identify as the bright fraternal chain. It is a chain which links every Masonic brother and related family member together by virtuous action. The eternal nature of this bond is signified by the Masonic motto, Virtus juncit mors non separabit, or what virtue unites, death cannot separate. This phrase was printed in public newspapers in upstate New York no later than 1828. So again, Joseph Smith was very familiar with these concepts. The motto was inscribed upon a plain gold band, which was presented to each brother who had received the 14th degree of the Rite of Perfection. This ring ceremony was associated with Masonry at least since 1783, and it was well known by Masons in the days of Joseph Smith. During the ceremony of reception, the candidate was specifically instructed, receive this ring as a token of alliance and to show that you have made a contract with virtue and with the virtuous. Do promise me, dear brother, never to part with this ring until death, and that you will never give it to any but your wife, your eldest son, or your nearest friend. To Masons, this ring was a token of the understanding that death could not break certain familial and fraternal ties, because those near and dear were united to them by virtue. It demonstrates a Masonic faith related to their belief in the immortality of the soul, that the tenderest ties of kinship and fraternity extend beyond the grave. Joseph Smith made use of this understanding in the King Follett Discourse, where he illustrated the principal using his very own ring, and that's a replica of Joseph Smith's ring on the right in the white square. Smith preached that God was a self-existing being and that man exists upon the same principle. Here's a quote from the discourse, you who mourn the loss of friends are only separated for a moment. Is it logic to say the spirit of man had a beginning and yet had no end? It does not have a beginning or end. My ring is like the existence of man. It has no beginning or end. William Law, former counselor in the First Presidency of the Church, wrote his impressions of General Conference in his diary. Conference is over, and some of the most blasphemous doctrines have been taught by Joseph Smith and others, he wrote. First, Law summarized what Joseph had taught, a plurality of gods, other gods as far above our God as he is above us, that he wrought out his salvation in the flesh with fear and trembling, the same as we do. Law continued with additional teachings given in the 1844 conference, which applied to both Masonry and the newly formed Council of 50, that secret meetings are all legal and right, and that the kingdom of God must be set up after the manner of a kingdom, and of course, have a king. There is little doubt that the prophet's King Follett discourse is Masonic in character. It was given on behalf of a Masonic brother, it was intended for a Masonic audience, and it contains numerous Masonic allusions. In the King Follett discourse, Joseph Smith elucidated for his followers the aim and purpose of human existence, using both analogies and language borrowed from Masonic discourse. Let's skip ahead to the evening of June 27th, 1844, Carthage Jail. Hiram Smith, master of Nauvoo Lodge, is shot to death. John Taylor is severely wounded and rolls under a bed. Finally, Joseph retreats to the second story window, raises his arms, and shouts, "O Lord, my God!" He is shot and tumbles to his death. The interesting thing about this is that many of the accounts of this action describe it in Masonic terms. A report of the Smith brothers' death found in the Times and Seasons of July 15, 1844, chastises the Brethren of the Mystic Tie, or the Freemasons, for not coming to the Smith brothers' aid. With uplifted hands, they gave such signs of distress as would have commanded the interposition and benevolence of savages or pagans. They were both Masons of good standing. Ye brethren of the Mystic Tie, what think ye? Where is our good master Joseph and Hiram? Is there a pagan, heathen, or savage nation on the globe that would not be moved on this great occasion as the trees of the forest by a mighty wind? Joseph's last exclamation was, "O Lord, my God." Brigham Young in 1860 asserted, "Joseph and Hiram Smith were master Masons, and they were put to death by Masons or through their instigation. And he gave the sign of distress, and he was shot by Masons while in the act." Orson F. Whitney in 1888 says, "Joseph, leaping the fatal window, gave the Masonic signal of distress. The answer was the roar of his murderers' muskets and the deadly balls that pierced his heart." The Masonic grand hailing sign of distress was taught to 19th century brethren of the craft in the Master Mason's degree. The sign was given by raising both hands and arms to the elbows perpendicularly, one on each side of the head, the elbows forming a square. That's a quote from Masonic exposition. The words, "O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son," were then spoken as the hands were solemnly lowered. King Solomon is said to have made this exclamation when informed of the death of Hiram Abiff. Freemasons of the day took an obligation that should I ever see that sign given or the word accompanying it, and the person who gave it appearing to be in distress, I will fly to his relief at the risk of my life. Joseph Smith's intentions while calling out the expression, "O Lord, my God," can never truly be known. However, his close associates would have known whether or not it was likely that the prophet would use Masonic language during his last moments on earth. It is telling that they imputed such a meaning to his last words. John D. Lee, secretary of the Council of 50, included the entire phrase from the ritual. He was describing Joseph's death and said, "Joseph left the door, sprang through the window, and cried out, 'O Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son?' as he sprang from the window, pierced with several balls." Zina D.H. Young was a member of the Holy Order, Quorum of the Anointed, later president of the Relief Society, and one of Joseph's plural wives. She proclaimed in 1878, "I am the daughter of a master mason. I am the widow of a master mason who, when leaping from the window of Carthage jail pierced with bullets, made the Masonic sign of distress. But gentlemen, these signs were not heeded except by the God of heaven." Thus, the men and women surrounding Joseph were unanimous on this point. With apparent pride in Smith's standing as a Freemason, they called the Masons in the crowd of assassins to task for failing to come to his aid. Joseph may very well have been appealing to his fellow Freemasons, many of whom were present in the mob who stormed the stairs and in the armed troops surrounding the jail. There are other possibilities that we'll discuss in our book. Modern Latter-day Saints, uncomfortable with the Masonic associations of this phrase, construe Joseph's exclamation to his Lord and God as a prayer. This interpretation is not at odds with a Masonic view of the grand hailing sign. Every Mason knows that he cannot fulfill this promise by his own strength, solely relying on the arm of flesh. And thus, every obligation ends with a plea to God. "So help me, God, and keep me steadfast in the due performance of the same." The grand hailing cry can be given, it is said, as a way to alert God to a man's distress when no human ear is there to hear. This sign is yet another example of a Masonic ritual with transformative power to overcome grief and sorrow. Meanwhile, inside the jail, Willard Richards, a Freemason himself, dragged John Taylor to safety in another room and concealed him under a mattress. Not completely sure that Joseph and Hiram were dead, he elevated his hands three times and exclaimed, "O Lord, my God, spare thy servants." Both Richards and Smith, in their hour of extremity, turned to Masonically inspired ritual to express their deepest longings. Now I'd like to turn the time over to my co-presenter, Nick Litursky. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Everybody, I'm really thankful to be able to present today. I'm excited. This is my first time presenting in a Mormon-related conference since 2005. So it's exciting to be back. So I'm really thankful for all of you who are here and for the opportunity. So this part of our presentation, I've given sort of a subtitle here. How do you bury a builder? Or also known as Emma was a good Mason and no dummy. Now, I've always seen Sunstone as an intersection. It's not just information, it's also about faith. And so I just want to give a little background here. For me, when I became a Mason, I recognized very quickly in the ceremonies, not just a similarity of temple ritual, which you know all of us have heard that, but a commonality between Joseph Smith's life and words and what was happening in the rituals. And that's actually what's inspired me to begin research toward what ultimately became this book. And so this is one piece of those similarities that has come out of the research that Joe and Cheryl and I did. So I want to take you back to where Cheryl left off. And the day after the martyrdom, at the Nauvoo Mansion, the home of Joseph and Emma, when Samuel Smith and others showed up at the mansion house with the bodies. They showed up there with the bodies, each in a pine casket, covered in branches and herbs, trying to cover the smell. And a group of men took them in to the dining room of the mansion. This is a layout of the original building. A good chunk of the building has since been taken down. If you go there, you'll see those foundation stones well beyond what's still standing. The dining room itself is 20 by 20, maybe 25 by 25 at best. So it's not a huge area. And this is where both of the brothers' bodies would lie in state. There at the bottom of the screen, you see the south wall of the building, and you see the windows marked there. That's where the head of the coffins were arranged. Each of the coffins were painted in black with a glass window over the faces. And I want to set a scene for you that gives you an idea what this was like, because that first night after the bodies were brought back was a family viewing. Just family members and a few very close friends. Dan Jones, not very long after the martyrdom, wrote, "There they lay in their coffins side by side, majestic men as they suffered side by side from prison to prison for years, and they labored together shoulder to shoulder to build the kingdom of Emmanuel. Eternal love bound them steadfastly to each other and to their God until death. And now my eyes beheld the blood of the two godly martyrs mingling in one pool in the middle of the floor. Their elderly mother, godly and sorrowful, on her knees in the midst of the blood between the two. A hand on each one of her sons who lay in gore, her heart nearly broken by the excruciating agony and the indescribable grief." So, Joseph Sr. having passed a couple of years earlier, these both were indeed the widow's sons, just as Hiram Abiff had been the widow's son. Lucy Mack Smith, in this description, it's macabre. It's horrible to contemplate the scene. And in this situation, we have the widows, Mary Fielding Smith, and of course, Emma, being brought in to see the bodies. And Emma, frankly, is completely losing her composure. She attempts to come in and can't handle it. She collapses. And she's brought out again. And then she comes in again. And finally is able even to handle seeing the bodies at all as she weeps. But there's something a little strange going on in this very intimate, private setting. B.F. Richmond, a Texan man who had come to talk with Joseph about the church purchasing land in Texas and moving there, and who had ended up visiting Nauvoo and then traveling to Carthage, had actually spent part of the time in the Carthage jail with Joseph and Hiram, and then came back to Nauvoo, saw the scene here. Said, "While the two wives were bewailing their loss and prostrate on the floor with their eight children, I noticed a lady standing at the head of Joseph Smith's body, her face covered, and her whole frame convulsed with weeping. She was the widow of William Morgan, a Masonic memory, and 20 years before had stood over the body of her husband, found at the mouth of Oak Orchard Creek in Link, Ontario. She was now the wife of a Mr. Harris, whom she married at Batavia, and who is now a saint in the Mormon church and a high mason. She's a short person with light hair and a very bright blue eyes and a pleasing countenance. I had called on her a few days previous to this occasion, and while conversing with her, I put my hand on a gilt-edged volume laying on the stand. It was Stearns on Masonry and contained the likeness of William Morgan. She said she'd taken it out and thought if the mob did come and she was obliged to flee or jump into the Mississippi, she would take it with her." This woman was Lucinda Morgan. And for those who don't know, her husband, William Morgan, not far away from Palmyra, New York, had written a Masonic expose and then was kidnapped by Masons and never seen again, presumably murdered. And Lucinda became something of a celebrity in the time. Everybody knew who she was, including the Smith family. And as you'll read in our book, the fact is Joseph Sr. was very likely a member of the same lodge where the kidnapping was plotted. Lucinda went on to remarry, and she and her second husband, George Harris, went on to become members of the LDS Church. They traveled along with the saints, and Lucinda, in fact, became one of Joseph Smith's wives. And here she is in this extremely intimate scene, this family viewing, sitting in a position of honor at the head of Joseph's body. And as it's said here, convulsing with weeping. Mr. Richmond talks about visiting her and seeing this book, Stearns on Masonry. That would be this book. And there's a problem with the description. Stearns on Masonry does not have a frontispiece of her first husband, William Morgan, in it. Stearns on Masonry is the book on the left. The book on the right is another book written at the same time by David Bernard called Light on Masonry. This book is much larger and, in fact, much more important to Mormon history. It includes testimonies not only by George Harris, Lucinda's second husband, but also by other people who would go on to be Mormons, such as W.W. Phelps. And there we have, right in the frontispiece, the portrait of William Morgan. I might add, it's a very idealized picture of William Morgan. William Morgan was a bricklayer, and you look at other illustrations and a bit of a rough-looking fellow. Here, of course, he looks like some great philosopher or professor. So by now you're saying, so what? Did this book say something important? As a matter of fact, it did. This book tells a story. The book tells the story of Hiram Biff. Now, as Cheryl's already talked about, Hiram was murdered by three men in the building of King Solomon's Temple. These men wanted the secrets of a master mason, and as Hiram refused to give them, they eventually killed him. Once they had killed him, they feared being caught. So they took the body, it says, and they carried it out the west gate and buried it in the rubbish till low 12 at night, in other words, midnight. When they three met agreeable to appointment and carried the body in a westerly course and buried it at the brow of a hill in a grave, dug due east and west, 6 feet perpendicular, and made their escape. So first, they buried him in the rubbish outside the west gate of the temple site. Second, they waited until midnight, took the body westward, and buried it at the brow of a hill. So then King Solomon sends out some of the fellow crafts to go search for the body, and to find the ruffians who had killed King Solomon. And as they did so, they went out and they, in fact, heard a rumor of where those men had gone, but they didn't find them. They came back and reported their news, but King Solomon said, well, go back out and find the body, or else I'm going to blame you. So they went back out in their pursuit, and one of the three that traveled in a westerly course, being more weary than the rest, sat down at the brow of a hill to rest and refresh himself, and in attempting to rise, caught hold of a sprig of acacia, which easily gave and excited his curiosity and made him suspicious of the deception, on which he hailed his companions, who immediately assembled, and on examination found the earth had been recently moved, and on moving the rubbish, discovered the appearance of a grave. So the ruffians had marked the grave with an acacia tree, which ended up giving away the location. So King Solomon sent fellow crafts to find the body. And once the body was found, King Solomon had him reburied in a sacred and permanent place of honor. So in this question and answer is given in a lecture, where was the body buried? under the Sanctum Sanctorum, or Holy of Holies, of King Solomon's temple, over which they erected a marble monument with this inscription delineated thereon: a virgin weeping over a broken column, with a book open before her, in her right hand a sprig of acacia, in her left an urn, Time standing behind her, with his arms enfolded in the ringlets of her hair. What do they denote? The weeping virgin denotes the unfinished state of the temple, the broken column, that one of the principal supporters of masonry had fallen, the book opened before her, that his memory was on perpetual record, the sprig of acacia, the timely discovery of his grave, the urn in her left hand, that his ashes were safely deposited under the Sanctum Sanctorum, or Holy of Holies, of King Solomon's temple, and Time standing behind her with his hands enfolded in the ringlets of her hair, that time, patience, and perseverance will accomplish all things. And this would have brought to mind, of course, the unfinished state of the temple in Nauvoo. And here we have a common Masonic representation from the 19th century of that illustration. So from another Masonic monitor of the time: the body of our Grand Master was buried three times. First, in the rubbish of the temple. Secondly, on the brow of a hill west of Mount Moriah. And thirdly and lastly, as the Sanctum Sanctorum, or Holy of Holies, of King Solomon's temple, as Jewish law would permit. So we have this pattern that that Hiram Abiff's body was buried and reburied and reburied in these various situations. So let's go back again to Nauvoo. On the next day, June 29th, after the family viewing, a public viewing was allowed, again in that small dining room. Now, the various accounts say anywhere from 10,000 to 20,000 people managed to file their way through this tiny, tiny dining room. I suspect that's an exaggeration, to be honest. That seems awfully difficult to manage that kind of crowd flow. But nonetheless, imagine the throngs that went through that room. By this time, everybody knew that Joseph had planned and had built a tomb. For a long time, the site of this tomb was in fact lost to modern historians. We can credit Joseph Johnston with doing the research that finally uncovered its location. By examining all of the extant records and this architectural drawing, as well as first-hand accounts from the time, we now know that this tomb was in fact built on the southeast corner of the temple site. At the time of Joseph's death, it was essentially finished. Depending on which account you credit, it was either finished about 2 weeks before Joseph's death, or at the time he was taken to Carthage, he gave the instruction for the floor to be laid and for the gates to be hung. And Joseph intended this to be the tomb for himself and his family members. The difficulty was that by the time Joseph was killed, there was a bounty out of $1,000 for anybody who could retrieve the head of his corpse. Everybody in the family was concerned that the graves of Joseph and Hiram would be desecrated if the men were buried in a place where they were known. So this ruled out the proper location for their burial, the planned location. And in fact, the only person ever known to be buried in the tomb was Catherine Smith, the wife of William. And even she was removed after a short time. So a deceptive plan was hatched instead. Once the viewing was done, the bodies were placed in a closet adjoining that dining room, hidden away. Coffins were then prepared and filled with sand and rocks. They were fully enclosed, so nobody could see inside. And only a few knew the secret. In fact, most of the pallbearers were unaware. Those who visited Nauvoo may have been to what's now called the Nauvoo Pioneer Cemetery, about 2 miles outside of the center of town. And of course, now it's beautiful and kept. This is an earlier photograph. But this was the Durfee Cemetery. And this is where, after a long procession, the two fake coffins were in fact buried. The exact location of those coffins was never given by the sextons, but the burials are still recorded in the sexton's record. Meanwhile, the actual bodies remained hidden in the closet in the Nauvoo mansion. So Joseph was murdered, and his family hid the body. Then, at midnight, 9 Freemasons moved the body southward, and they buried them in the northwest corner of the foundation of the Nauvoo house at the brow of a small rise near the river. That would have been, if you can see my arrow here, in this upper left corner of the building. So at this time, the Nauvoo house was unfinished. And this is a painting actually by David Hiram Smith of where the building remained in the condition it was for quite some time. The story of this happening was in fact pretty remarkable. The 9 men secretly took the burials there at that midnight hour. The day had been hot. It had been largely clear. It wasn't until about 10 p.m. that a single dark cloud began to approach Nauvoo over the Mississippi. And as the bodies were being buried at midnight, suddenly there was an enormous clap of thunder and a huge thunderstorm fell on Nauvoo. And if you've been in Nauvoo in the summer in a thunderstorm, that is not a shocking description. So while they had buried the bodies and heaped brush over the spot and rubble, the storm took care of the rest and the site was obliterated. This is another view of the Nauvoo house at the time. And this gives you an idea of how this was, in fact, on a rise over the river. These are the doors that the men would have gone in from the opposite side of the building of what David Hiram painted. And so you can see the elevation that it had above the river. So the bodies remain there into the fall. At some point, Emma and Mary Fielding Smith became concerned because mob activity was increasing and circumstances were such that they felt that the bodies needed to be moved. There were also plans to possibly resume construction on the Nauvoo house, which would have disturbed the graves. So they determined that it was important to move the bodies. As it happened, they made a plan for a particular night. And then Emma sent word that they needed to postpone. For some reason, Emma then proceeded to go forward with the plan to move the bodies as originally scheduled, but did not tell Mary Fielding Smith about it. That night, Mary Fielding Smith had difficulty sleeping and happened to cross the whole operation quite by accident as she went out for a walk. So under Emma's direction, the bodies were moved northwestward to the homestead property. And these Freemasons who had moved the body under her direction then marked the grave by moving a bee house on top of them. And as we go forward, you'll see there this accounts for some of the confusion later, whether this was a bee house or a spring house, because it was in fact two different instances. And one thing also, the bee house was, you know, strangely appropriate, because the bee in Freemasonry is actually an emblem of both industry, which is familiar to people from a Mormon background, but also of regeneration and renewal. By summer or autumn of 1846, the bodies were again moved to a secret location in Davidson Hibbert's woods. As David Hiram Smith became a little older, he frequented a spot on Hibbert's property. It began to be known as David's Chamber. And you can still drive by that area on the highway along the Mississippi River. Around 1863, which would have placed him roughly 19 years old, David would have composed the hymn, The Unknown Grave. Sometime between then and Emma's death, with the assistance of a trusted black servant by the name of Cleveland, Emma had the bodies moved back to the homestead, this time placing them beneath the existing foundation of a spring house. Emma would later herself be buried nearby. Now, the site gradually fell into decay and its specific location was forgotten by most. There's some suggestion that there were family members who knew the general spot, but those accounts are somewhat questionable. The building certainly decayed and went away. This is a reconstruction that has since been created. But the foundation itself did remain, though it was largely covered up. At one point, there was actually a hog pen on the spot. Finally, it was the grandson of Joseph Smith, our LDS president, Frederick M. Smith, who happened to be an accomplished Freemason, who found a reason to locate the bodies. The Keokuk Dam had been constructed, and the Mississippi River waters were rising. They became concerned because the general area where the bodies were thought to be stood in threat of being flooded. And so President Smith sent W.O. Hands to try to locate the bodies. Once those bodies were found, President Smith had them reburied in a sacred and permanent place of honor, where they remain to this day. So what we have is this parallel. Now, are the parallels exact? No, they're not. But we still have this multiple set of burials. We have a burial that was essentially under rubble at a construction site. We have a midnight reburial shortly after. We have yet another at the brow of a hill. And then finally, after the body is had to be rediscovered and found by trusted Masons, it is in fact buried appropriately with a sacred monument. In the end, as I said, you know, Emma was a good Mason. Joseph Smith, at one point, as he was establishing the Relief Society, said that he wanted the sisters to be good Masons and learn how to keep a secret. And that's precisely what Emma did. Brigham, in the meantime, wanted to know exactly where the burials were. On the surface, he said that he wanted to fulfill Joseph's dying wish of having the bodies placed in the tomb. I think we also have to consider that any would-be leader who took possession of the bodies and took care of them would have had some additional credibility to their claim of leadership. It was Brigham, after all, who made a point of going after Joseph's horse and going after other property of Joseph's. Emma, on the other hand, made sure that Joseph's body stayed on Smith property, not on church property. Emma made sure that the location was in her control and not in the control of Brigham Young or any other would-be successor. And so Emma was no fool. Emma saw to it that the remains of her husband and Hiram, who she also loved, were kept sacred. And in the end, they received the honors that they were due. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Well, thank you both for great presentations. We have some questions. And I'll start with the first one. Why doesn't the LDS Church acknowledge its Masonic roots? What do Masons think about the LDS Church using many of their rituals? It's a question from Alicia.
Well, it's interesting how many of the Masonic rituals have been lost to the LDS Church. I think starting from the days of Brigham Young, I alluded to a little bit of the anger that they had, that they felt that Freemasons had been involved in allowing Joseph Smith to be killed, that none of the Masons had gone to his aid. And so they're quite angry about Masonry. Brigham Young declined to continue Masonry when they moved to Utah. And although I think he always had a special spot in his heart for the obligations he had made, and he continued to wear his Masonic pin for quite some time, but they did not rebuild, build up a Masonic lodge once they'd gone to Utah. And so I think that gradually Masonry fell out of favor. There was a big conflict in the early days of Utah between the Freemasons and the Mormons, and that continued for quite some time. So I think that there's always been a little bit of tension between the rituals that we continue to have and Mormon leaders not wanting to really say that they came from Masonry. What about you, Nick?
I think that's all true. I think would also add that I think that, for lack of a better word, Brighamite Mormonism really has come to define Revelation in a particular way. That over time, that distrusts outside influence. And so the idea of cultural influences has been seen as being at odds with divine revelation. So it's been looked upon with disfavor to say that Joseph was influenced by things in his environment. Therefore, it becomes uncomfortable to say that Joseph was influenced by a lifetime around Freemasonry or many other things that Joseph was exposed to. You know, as Cheryl has said, I think there was also a substantial wound. As you'll read in our book, you know, not only around the killing of Joseph Smith, but also around other events, such as the death of Parley P. Pratt, as time went on, such that a distancing did occur. There was also, I know there's another part of the question. Oh, what do Masons feel? There was a time, certainly, when there were Masons who were very bitter about the similarities that they were aware of. And there are certainly some polemical works by Masons, primarily from the early part of the 20th century, suggesting that the Mormons, you know, stole a ritual from the Masons. And I don't think we really see that anymore, quite frankly. For one thing, Masons don't these days typically see their rituals as something pristine that belongs exclusively to them. They tend to understand their rituals as something quite universal that really has come down from a lot of different cultural influences itself. So they don't hold the same sort of ownership that earlier times may have. And yeah, I think they simply have gotten past those days of competition and ownership, to where, of course, today there are many individuals who are both active Mormons and active Freemasons.
Yeah, let me just expand on that a little bit. I think during Joseph Smith's time, there were a lot of Masonic rituals being developed at the time. And so it was looked upon with favor that you were a ritualist who was developing ritual in the Masonic fashion. And so this is what Joseph Smith was doing. And so I don't think that Masons necessarily looked at that as being stealing their ritual, but using the tradition to create ritual was a good thing. And I think it's more Mormons that are disturbed by the fact that there's influence of Masonry than Masons, I don't think, are disturbed by that.
Okay, we have, I'm going to combine a couple of questions here. One question from Timothy: how long were Masonic aprons worn by Satan in the Salt Lake Temple? How far beyond 1990? And also, when did the practice of burying deceased endowed members of the LDS Church in temple robes begin?
Okay, well, I don't have a lot of experience in that late. I mean, my Masonic research has more been done up to the Nauvoo period. However, I know that when I went through the temple, it was 1981, you did not see Satan wearing the Masonic apron. He did mention the apron that he had on, but he was cut off, so you couldn't see the apron he had on in the film. So at least from that time, we have not seen an apron being worn by Satan in the temple. I know that early live sessions, that was that they had Masonic, that Satan would wear a Masonic apron with the symbols on it. Do you know anything more about that, Nick?
I would clarify, I mean, it's certainly, you know, having participated in the Salt Lake Temple in live sessions and Manti, certainly the apron worn by Lucifer in a live session did have embroidery with similar symbols to a Masonic apron. That said, I would distinguish it from a Masonic apron, because I have never seen a Masonic apron that was dark blue or purple, which that was in its entirety. Masonic aprons are typically white with colored embroidery, in some cases a light blue, but usually white with light blue trim and colored embroidery. The apron worn by Lucifer as an emblem of his power and priesthoods, plural, in that live session is dark blue or purple, almost to the point of black, but like not quite, so you can see the embroidery. And it is similar symbols to those of Freemasonry.
So maybe it was meant to symbolize a corruption of Masonry, spurious Masonry.
Yeah, I would say that's more likely. I can't say for sure whether I would expect. Just trying to remember. I honestly can't remember if I did a live session in Salt Lake after 1990 to be able to answer that question with any definitive, you know, experience. And I would not have after I left the LDS Church in 2005. So I'm afraid I can't, you know, give you anything better than that. But again, I would distinguish that it was not properly a Masonic apron. Even though it had certainly some allusion to it.
Yeah, I have done live sessions since then, but I have not done many, so I don't really recall. And I do not think that the apron had any symbols on it at all. of the satanic apron.
There was a second part of that question as well. I'm sorry, Jason.
The temple robes.
Yes, endowed members being buried in temple robes.
When did that start? I'm not sure.
I don't know either.
Okay, I have another question for you then.
Sorry.
This one is from Bryce. And he says that someone once told me that Joseph Smith expected to be killed on June 24th, St. John's Day. What would be the significance of being incarcerated or dying this day?
So that may have come from me discussing my research with people. So it's interesting that there is some indication that Joseph negotiated the day of his surrender to fall on the 24th. In Masonic practice, there are 2 days of the year reflected as St. John's Day, one for St. John the Baptist in December, and one for St. John the Martyr in June. St. John the Beloved and St. John the Baptist is the martyr. So the St. John the Baptist Day does refer to martyrdom specifically. And so Joseph, clearly having a premonition that he would not survive the experience at Carthage, may have timed his departure for there with symbolic intent. And that would be no different, frankly, than Jesus, for example, entering Jerusalem on a white ass, which we happen to know a lot of would-be messiahs also did in an attempt to fulfill scripture. So, you know, the idea of individuals making a gesture of symbolic import is not particularly unusual.
We find this really fascinating in our research, that many of the things that Joseph did were intentionally meant to fulfill prophecy, just as Nick noted that many would-be messiahs went ahead and tried to fulfill prophecy. But in Joseph Smith's case, there are also so many things that were fulfilled that he didn't mean to, like the pattern of burials, for example, that Nick pointed out. He couldn't have, fixed that, but it so happened that it went along really well with the ritual. So we found some very, very interesting things happen that just coincidences that happen to fall together, and that's always so fascinating.
I mean, to be perfectly honest, you know, very early in motivating my research, coming from my perspective early on as sort of a zealous believer, I wondered at one point if maybe this was all a prophecy of Joseph. If all this ritual was just foretelling Joseph's life, that was honestly part of my starting point. It's not where I ended up.
Sometimes it seems as if it has something to do with it.
Does April 6th have a Masonic connection?
Beth, Nick.
Not that I'm aware of, but I can tell you one fun thing about April 6th. The Grand Lodge of Illinois, which had fallen apart after the murder of William Morgan, was reorganized on April 6th of 1840, coincidentally at the encouragement and insistence of James Adams, who was a close confidant of Joseph Smith. And, you know, we have wondered about that. It certainly can't be proven one way or another, but we find it interesting that that he would, in fact, go to Springfield and push so hard for the reorganization to take place on that day that happened to be the 10th anniversary of the organization of the Mormon Church.
We also have the Nauvoo Masonic Lodge being dedicated on the 5th of April. So it wasn't that it was a Masonic date, it was a Mormon date, but somehow seems like they, the Mormons, sort of connected it with Masonry.
Okay, we've got one more question here. And this is from Peter. The timeline has Joseph grasping Masonry's details and depths very fast after being initiated. Do you feel he picked up these things in his youth from Masonic family and had longer to ponderize them?
Yeah, so many people who talk about Mormonism and Masonry say that Joseph couldn't possibly have used Masonry because he'd only been a Mason for a few days or for a few weeks. But in reality, Joseph Smith was immersed in Masonry all of his life. He did come from a Masonic family, but it was cultural in his area that he lived. It would be like someone today not knowing who Batman was. Even if you've never seen a Batman movie or read a Batman comic book, you know who Batman is. Just because it's sort of all around in our culture. And Freemasonry permeated the culture that Joseph Smith lived in. And especially after the William Morgan affair, where William Morgan, who had revealed Masonic secrets, was reportedly killed by Masons, it made a huge splash. And right in Joseph Smith's area where he lived as a young man, there were anti-Masons going around reenacting the degrees so that everyone could see what exactly happened in the degree. And there were newspapers that talked about it and lectures on it. And so everyone was very conversant with Masonry and its symbolism. So Joseph Smith would not have had to been a Mason himself to know all about Masonry.
So these are just a couple examples of books that were much better sellers than the Book of Mormon at the time. These were extremely popular books that I talked about in my presentation. And they lay out all the ceremonies in detail. And they were all over the place. People had access to these. They were reading them. They were talking about them. They were in the newspapers. There were entire newspapers being published just for the purpose of exposing Freemasonry. W.W. Phelps, in particular, actually established a number of anti-Mormon newspapers, one of which was in Canandaigua, close to Palmyra. All of these things, like Cheryl said, they were completely surrounding Joseph Smith. In his growing up years. We also, it's clear that his father was a Mason. His brother Hiram was a Mason. But we even go further back than that. And in our book, we show that, from even before Joseph's birth, his father was fascinated with Masonic ritual and legend. And so, what we have often said, Joseph was immersed in Freemasonry literally from the cradle to the grave. And of course, I just talked about the grave end of that, but you'll be able to read about the cradle end.
Right. So we lay out some of the things that happened ever since Joseph Smith's birth. And we talk about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, the first vision. We talk about Masonic influence in the very early days of the church. So he wasn't just putting Masonry into Mormonism in the 1840s. He started very early putting Masonry into Mormonism and experimenting with Masonic ritual and organizations. We talk about Missouri and we talk about the Danites having a strong Masonic influence. And so you'll be fascinated just to see how much Masonry comes into the Mormon church before we get to Nauvoo.
Okay, we have a question here that I'm glad somebody asked because I wanted to ask it myself.
Okay.
This is from Alicia. Can you tell us more about Mrs. Morgan? Was her Masonry connection a point of interest to Joseph Smith specifically?
Yes. Yes, and Nick, why don't you tell them about your little...
Flag excursion?
Yes.
Lucinda's kind of a hero. What can I say? So as I said in my presentation, Lucinda was the widow of William Morgan, and William Morgan, his exposure and the subsequent outplay of that, again, this is somebody everybody knew about. There was just no cultural way to be ignorant of what was called the Morgan affair. And so Lucinda was a national heroine. She was a person who had the sympathy of everybody around her. There's actually even a rumor that William Morgan knew Joseph Smith Sr. There's one account claiming that he was a halfway convert of Joseph Smith Sr., which is interesting. But Lucinda went on, as I said, to interestingly enough, marry another Freemason, George W. Harris. And that was a shock to people. That hit the newspapers because people had been sending her money. They had been sending her on speaking circuits. Everybody was supporting her and feeling sorry for her. And then she, in a large part, betrayed the anti-Masonic cause by, oh my goodness, marrying a Mason. So they tried to go off and, kind of live a peaceful life. And then the Mormon missionaries found them. And it wasn't very long after that, actually, that Joseph invited George and Lucinda to come to Far West. And, if you look at Mormon settlement patterns, because of the land speculation that went on and such, it was really common for parcels of land to be given closer to Joseph Smith, dependent on favor and influence in the church. And sure enough, they come and Lucinda and George are given a lot across the street. So it's clear that Joseph latched onto this pretty quickly and caught that interest. It also just happens that Lucinda appears to have been a very early plural wife of Joseph. It is suggested that she was probably the first after Fanny Alger. And we can debate whether Fanny Alger was a plural wife or just an incident. So Lucinda and Joseph become involved very early on. And yes, I think he clearly was very interested in that Masonic end. Joseph, as you'll read in the story, in our book, Joseph from the start was interested in this story of a Masonic restoration in which pure Masonry and pure Christianity would both be restored and become one. There's another book by Salem Town that actually prophesied this going on. It was written back in 1818, and we talk about this in our book. And this is something that was expected in the culture at the time. So this idea was there, and Lucinda was a key to it. Lucinda had the memory of William Morgan. She was kind of a key piece to bring into this. And so, yes, I think she ends up being an influential picture behind the scenes. She had two children. One was Thomas, and one was Lucinda, also named Lucinda Wesley. And I call her Lucinda the Elder and Lucinda the Younger, just to kind of keep things simple. Lucinda the Younger ended up as a teenager taking care of Joseph Smith during an illness in Nauvoo. She ended up meeting B.F. Johnson, Benjamin F. Johnson, in doing so, and the two fell in love. They were getting very close, and B.F. Johnson wanted to ask her to marry him. And he asked Joseph whether that was a good idea. And oddly enough, Joseph not only said yes, but yes, and you need to do it right away. You need to do this right now. Well, Benjamin Johnson didn't do that because he found out his mother up in Quincy was ill and he needed to go take care of her. So he moved up there for a couple months. In the meantime, Lucinda very promptly was married off to a steamboat captain named David Smith, no relation. David Smith was non-Mormon and by some accounts, kind of a ne'er-do-well or looked upon as such. So, you know, they live out their life in Nauvoo for a little while. That wedding took place in May of 1842. And their quote unquote child was born in August. So some really interesting circumstances around that birth. As it happens, they end up moving down to Tennessee. Lucinda and George follow the Saints out to Iowa, but then Lucinda left George and went down to live with David and Lucinda the younger in Tennessee, and she ultimately passed away there. Lucinda the younger and David finally came out here to Oregon, where not too far away from where I live. I'm just outside of Portland. It took me the last 15 years. After finding, years ago, just a little reference that they'd helped settle Salem, Oregon, which made no sense. And just here 2-3 months ago, I finally found out where Lucinda the Younger actually ended up. And so I guess it was Memorial Day, wasn't it, Cheryl?
Yeah.
I had a chance to go to this little tiny village of Graves, Illinois, Graves, Oregon. And I found the grave of Lucinda Smith, as her married name was, and was able to really, kind of pay tribute to her and see the end of her story. And, to me,
Lucinda Smith. She was born Lucinda Smith because her father was David Smith, right?
Well, no. This is Lucinda.
Well, she married David Smith.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is Lucinda Wesley Morgan, who married David Smith.
Okay.
But, of course, her stepfather was Joseph. but, it was such a wonderful kind of bookend, really, to our research for me, because it was one sort of stray piece that had been hanging out there that I had wondered about. And to finally find where she ended up, and after a really difficult life, she'd lost her father at the age of 2 in a nationwide.
Nick, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop you there.
We've run out of time,
guys, but there's several questions that were asked in the last few minutes that would take a long time for you guys to answer. So I encourage everyone to go and look at the Q&A in the app and continue.
We'll try to answer some of them, and we encourage you. I've looked at the questions that were answered these last few, and they are definitely covered in our book. So be looking for it to come out in the fall, we're hoping. So Method Infinite.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.